Hello, and welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Pia Hugo, former member of the New Apostolic Reformation. Pia, it's good to be back and to talk about the system. We've given people just a broad overview of what the system is and how it created the New Apostolic Reformation, but it's a much bigger thing, I think, than people realize, and it goes back through a very, very long time, a lot further than people realize. So when people look at all of the news today and they see the politics and the money and the crowds and all of this mess, they think it's something that just happened, but it didn't just happen. It's sort of like a snowball that's going down a hill. It gets bigger and bigger, but it started with this little tiny thing. And if you're not watching it, then by the time it crashes through your house, it's gotten so big that, you know, it did it along the way. It grew along the way. And today we're going to talk about some of those major milestones of that. And it all goes back to this. The system has existed for a very long period of time, and it started to generate a lot of money over time. And the system has gotten so out of control that I don't think anyone can really steer this thing.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me again. And you're absolutely right. I have started to really listen to a lot of your videos going back all the way to the Azusa Street Revival back in 1906. And all the characters that you mention in your videos are very familiar to me, but not in the way that you describe. They were seen as almost like demigods, you know, like William Seymour, you know, and Charles Parham and all of them guys, like William Branham, you know, himself, like they were always like these men that we should all just emulate, and how anointed they were, and we needed to like finish what they started. And I'm here to say to your audience, can we not finish what they started? Can we just really put a halt to this whole machine? You know, we've called the NAR system the well-oiled money-making machine. And I am, you know, very happy and honored to be in your podcast, because I want to help you, and I want to help anybody else out there who want to expose the dangers of this system, because really it's hurt so many people, and it really needs to stop. So today I wanted to talk about, before I talk about my own personal experiences with NAR and the organization I was a part of prior to NAR, which is PDI, People of Destiny International. But before I talk about that, I wanted to bring up this concept that I just discovered, John. So as you know, I'm a former history and economics teacher, so I'm always reading up on the latest. And this author, he's a businessman, and he's authored a few other business books, but this one just came out this past May 2026. And his name is Eric Ries, R-I-E-S. And he has a book entitled Incorruptible, Why Good Companies Go Bad and How Great Companies Stay Great. So the title really like caught my attention, and I just kind of took a look at it. And I was surprised that this concept that he came up with, financial gravity, like how relevant it really is to what you and I have been talking about, you know, within the NAR system. So let me just talk about what financial gravity is. So Rice asserts that the more successful an organization becomes, the more outside forces come into play. So as the company grows, you've got investors, lawyers, board directors, stakeholders, and, you know, clients, like high-end, like demanding clients. They begin to exert a gravitational pull. He calls it a gravitational pull that he has since dubbed financial gravity. So the pressure forces the original founders and leaders of the company to begin prioritizing short-term financial gains at the expense of the long-term purpose of the company. And so what they don't realize, what these leaders don't realize, is that it's actually a downward pull. That's why he calls it a gravity. It pulls them down in the long run. And many of these once successful companies, they never recover. So Rice doesn't believe that it is outright corruption or bad managers that destroy most companies. He believes it's the nature of business growth. And so, John, this goes back to what you and I were saying, that you can have really nice, well-meaning, well-intentioned Christian leaders who just want to spread the gospel and they want to start good churches. But eventually, they seem to turn bad because of this gravitational pull by external forces. So I'm going to try to explain further. Financial gravity can show up in small moments, like when somebody decides not to speak up, like at a board meeting, because the president or the founder says, oh, well, you know, this is really what the investors want, and this is how we're going to make more money. So you might be, you know, a smart board member, and you're thinking, huh, well, this might work in the short run, but in the long run, we might actually hurt people. But they stay silent because, again, it's this subtle but powerful pull, right? Gravitational pull towards making more money. Financial gravity can show up when there's a team within the company and they opt for what's easier, what's more convenient, and usually what is heavily compromised, because they think, again, it's going to look better for the quarterly financial reports. Maybe we can get raises from the boss, because again, it's no longer about the purpose. It's about making that quick buck. So over time, these small choices then become the default. And what started out as seemingly small and harmless choices, they start becoming the norm. And then the norm becomes the culture within the company. So I'll give you some examples in the financial corporate world. So, you know, Target, right? We all, you know, have been to Target stores at least once in our life, I think. So Target, about a decade ago, began celebrating Pride Month. So this is June. This happens to be Pride Month for people who don't know. And so Target decided that they were going to be more, you know, friendlier to the LGBTQ community, and they wanted a broader corporate diversity and inclusion strategy. So in their research, the initiative was supposed to, again, bring more money because it would expand their customer base. So they tried it. And for a while, it kind of worked because it did bring in newer customers who normally did not shop at Target. Okay. Over time, however, Target experienced serious backlash. I'm sure you know this, John, because the long-standing customer base of Target, surprise, surprise, included a lot of conservative, family-oriented customers, right? And they were not happy to see Pride t-shirts, Pride toys, Pride, just kiddie merchandise on display. So what happened in 2023, there was this viral social media boycott and even in-store confrontations regarding these specific merchandise. And all that negative media cost Target to, for the first time in history, have significant sales drops. And all of a sudden, the board of directors, all these people who thought it was a great idea, they all started backtracking. And now they still do have some Pride displays, but significantly reduced.
So what you're talking about is more important than people realize, and it's something that I'm glad that you went there because I want to continue to go there as we talk. What we're talking about in the business world, we call it growing pains. You grow, and if you're not cautious how you grow, you're going to have pains, and some of those pains can actually destroy your business. You can lose your business over the growing pains. Now take that concept and apply that to a church. Every church, like it or not, big or small, is a business. It has to be a business to run, to operate. To keep the lights on, it has to run like a business. I have talked to so many people who say, we were in this really good church. Everybody loved everybody. It was this nice, small church, and suddenly they grew so large so quickly. And when they did, we didn't like it. No longer are we close to the people. It feels cold and formal. They'll use the Latterine words, which is kind of funny. But they'll talk about the things that they miss about how when it was smaller. And that's because the church itself has had growing pains. They grew very quickly. They grew as a business very quickly. They're generating a lot of revenue, but they didn't do it in a way that appealed to their primary customer, which is the congregants. And so this is a huge problem. Now take that concept and think back to C. Peter Wagner and John Wimber, teaching church growth strategy. How can you make your churches explode? How can you make them grow quickly? And I know that there are some Wimber crowd out there that are going to argue in the comments, no, Wimber was not like this. Go back and talk to some of the people who knew him in the early years. It was the church growth strategy that he was part of. And he was connected to PDI, which I've mentioned a few times cautiously because I'm still exploring that, but we're going to go deeper with the connection with church growth strategy to PDI, which is connected to, we'll get into this more, the shepherding, discipling programs, and that is the bridge back to Branhamism that everybody seems to be missing.
Yeah, I'm excited. So going back to the financial gravity concept, he gives an example of companies that actually did stay true to their original purpose. And so my example that I want to bring up today is Chick-fil-A. Okay. So I don't know, where do you live again, John? Are you allowed to say?
I'm allowed to say. I'm in Indiana.
You're in Indiana.
I go to Chick-fil-A. I love it, but I can't go there on Sunday.
That's right, because they're closed. Because again, it's a Christian-run company that has stayed really true to their roots. And I'm going to read what they said about Pride Month, because I just saw it a day ago. And I'm very impressed by how they're approaching this whole Pride Month thing. They said that we are proud to protect our values and stay grounded in what we believe. Respect for others does not require us to celebrate or endorse every message or every movement. We will not change who we are to appeal to the crowd. We will not compromise our beliefs for approval. Our position is simple. We will remain respectful, but we will also remain true to our principles. Now, why can't we do that as a church? If Chick-fil-A, which is a true money-making enterprise, they're not hiding that, right? They're not pretending to be a church. They're not pretending to be a Christian ministry. They flat out came out and said, well, hey, we're going to try to make the best chicken you've ever had. But we also happen to be Christian. So, yeah, exactly what you were saying earlier. I wrote down here, today, many churches and ministries have embraced this all-American modern worship production. Okay, I wrote this down. It's the high-end sound systems. It's the atmospheric lighting. It's the fog machines. It's the digital billboards, the mega size entertainment screens, the coffee bars. And don't forget, we've got to have preachers who know how to wear trendy clothing. In fact, apparently it's kind of a thing for them to tell their audience, this is where I got this t-shirt. This is where I got these sneakers. I mean, I remember watching one sermon. I'm like, why is he saying that? You know, I'm so naive. And it's like, oh, because they're being paid. They're being paid to advertise these brands. And I mean, honestly, they're not even trying to hide just a little bit that they are money-making machines. So, and again, going back to why is it that there is no one on staff? There is no board member. There's no one in the congregation saying or shouting like, hey, can you just stick to the gospel? We don't care what you're wearing, you know, we just want to hear the word of God. But it's that financial gravity. No one wants to speak out. No one wants to challenge these pastors, these preachers, because it's all tied to their income. They all work for the company or the church, sorry, church slash company. You know, they all work for them or they're so invested already, right? They've been there for years. They've given their heart and soul to these church organizations. Like, and again, they've been lulled. They've been lulled into complacency. So, I watched your podcast your interview with Judith and Vincent Desjardins. Everybody needs to watch that one. I really enjoyed that. And I think it was Judith who dubbed these churches the Church of Codependency or something like that.
Yes.
I thought that was perfect. I called it complacency. She calls it codependency. It's the same thing. You shut off your critical thinking skills and now you're just going with the flow. And I mean, it's one thing if the flow was just false teachings, but it's more than that. It's more than that. It's become really, really dangerous and poisonous. And I really want to get to that later on, how my own family, my own children really suffered because we were in this system.
I'm really glad that you brought up Chick-fil-A for multiple reasons. Number one, when you started mentioning the chicken, my mouth is watering and I'm actually struggling to speak because my mouth is watering. But number two, the bigger reason, let's think about this for a minute. Church was made for the people, not people made for the church. But in today's modern weird world, they have it flipped totally upside down, where you are made for the church and you must be tied to that church. Had a conversation just yesterday with a guy. This is spread globally. And I was talking to a guy in Costa Rica, and he says that's even spread into Costa Rica. He said, I was just invited to go play guitar or something at another church. And whenever I said I was going to go there, they said something to the effect, well, what have they got that we don't have here at our church? Because they think the church, it's just upside down. The whole thing's wrong. Mm-hmm. Chick-fil-A does one thing right besides the chicken that is that's actually even more powerful if you think about this. They recognized how people changed over time and how they the average customer, they're there at Chick-fil-A because they want in and out quickly. They want to be very, very quick. They're busy. They've got, you know, a few minutes on lunch break. We got to go get chicken, come back. And Chick-fil-A is the darndest fastest place you can go to. They have modified all of their drive-through lines where when you go through the drive-through, there's multiple lanes, there are people out front. Other businesses have now started to replicate what Chick-fil-A created with their model. And what they did was they found out we're not made, and it goes back to what I said about the church. We're made for those people. Those people aren't made for us. We need to tailor what we do. Our business strategy needs to be around those people. When you have a church that is built upside down, they're doing what every other vendor is doing wrong that's competing with Chick-fil-A. They're trying to say, we're it. We're the big one. We're the one wearing the fancy clothes, and you should wear our clothes, and here's the brand. They care more about themselves than they do the people. And Chick-fil-A did that right. The problem that I see as this grows and continues over time, it's part of what I said earlier. It is the growing pains. You grow so big that you're so invested in yourself that you forget about the customer, which is something that every business that grows, there comes a point when they do it by mistake, and then if they catch themselves fast enough, they can correct, and their business can grow, you know, really, really big. But those who don't, they fall flat on their face. And in my opinion, the churches that are doing this, that think that the people are made for us, to serve us, those are the churches that are going to fall flat on their face.
Exactly. I mean, and again, like I said earlier, if Chick-fil-A was able to retain their original purpose, right? They know why people go there, because it's yummy chicken and it's fast service, simple. I don't understand why we as a church cannot just keep it just as simple. The gospel is not complicated. So church is unfortunately, like you said, no longer there for the people, right? It's supposed to be a safe space where broken people can go and have an encounter with Jesus, where they can hear the truth of the gospel and they can get saved and healed and delivered. And that's it. By the power of the cross. That's it. Nothing to do with us. Nothing to see here. We're just ordinary people all pointing to the cross. However, because now we are also a business, now, like you said, we've grown. More and more people are coming to our churches. Now we are that well-oiled money-making machine, and we just need to keep the wheels and the cogs spinning, because if we don't, everything's just going to collapse and we will have nothing to show for it. So, I mean, that's what they think. So I just want to get more personal now that I've, you know, you and I get it. It's called financial gravity, according to this guy, Eric Rice. All right. So you mentioned PDI, People of Destiny International. So before NAR exploded into the scene in 1994, when Toronto Blessing came into California, right? And C. Peter Wagner, Cheon, Lou Engel really caught the fire. And now it's like taking over the land. So before NAR came PDI. And how I was introduced to PDI was through my former brother-in-law, Cheon, because Cheon was best friends with Larry Tomczak and CJ Mahaney. These are his words. So back in 1986, when I first met Che and then married his brother upon his recommendation, by the way, I honestly don't think I would have married my ex-husband if Che and Sue weren't so convinced that it was God's will for me to marry Sue's brother. So anyway, that's a different story. So now that my husband and I needed a church to go to, because Che and Sue, by this time, they were in California. They had started their own PDI church over there called Abundant Life Community Church. Okay, this was, they started it in 1984. So now we're in 1986, we're married, me and Sue's brother, but we're still living in Maryland, okay? We're not yet part of Abundant Life Community Church. I was still in college. I went to George Washington University. I was getting my degree in economics and finance. And so Che said, oh, you should definitely go to my buddy's church, my buddy CJ. So I would like you to put up this photograph of his buddy, Che's buddy, CJ Mahaney. And that is a photo of me and my husband being introduced to the church. We were newlyweds. We were baby Christians. I think that was when I was like maybe 20 years old. And I was just thrilled. so excited to be part of this cutting edge church that was so anointed. And according to Cheon, CJ Mahaney and his other buddy, Larry Tomczak, like these were the two men that was gonna change the world. And I was so blessed that I got to be, you know, part of what CJ Mahaney and Larry Tomczak were doing, you know, in Washington, D.C. So, all right. So now that I look back, I mean, I'm laughing because, oh my gosh, how gullible could I have been just drinking the Kool-Aid by the pitcher? And so I quickly became part of CLC, Covenant Life Church. And when I graduated in 1988, 2 years later, I even decided to work for them, John. Now, mind you, I have a degree in economics and finance. And I actually had job offers at, you know, these banks and financial firms. You know, I had interned in one of these financial investments firm. And it was my original career goal to become a financial analyst, John. This was before I met my husband, before I met Che, before I met Sue, before I was part of this whole system. I was a normal, quote unquote normal, college kid that wanted to have, you know, a good career. Nothing wrong with that. But I remember what your guests were saying, you know, I think it was Judith who said that back in the day, in the 1980s, if you were a part of these churches, that meant that you were totally into the end times theology. You believe that any moment now, Jesus was gonna show up and rapture all of us, and we would be spared a 7-year tribulation. So heck, if that's my future, if that is my immediate future, what good is it for me to save my money for a nice house? What good is it that I pursue this career in finance when we all need to just be about preparing for the coming of Jesus Christ, which was very imminent? So I turned down all those job offers, John, and I decided to become the assistant to the comptroller and the conference director of PDI. It's a nice title for a glorified secretary. That's basically what I was. In fact, during my interviews, I was told by the financial comptroller, nice guy, smart guy, he actually told me, like, you know, you can be making more money elsewhere. I'm just curious, like, why would you want to work for us? And I said, oh, this is where it's happening, though. Like, you know, this is worth it for me. You know, and he said, yeah, but you're overqualified for this position. And I said, oh, I don't care. You know, like, I could be cleaning the toilets and, you know, whatever, taking care of babies, or you just put me anywhere you want, because I just want to be part of the most amazing anointed movement on planet Earth right now. Like, I totally believe that. And so I remember the comptroller kind of scratching his head, because I don't think he was fully, I don't think he himself was fully convinced. But the other guy, you know, the conference director, is like, oh yeah, yes and amen, you're hired. So anyway, this is 1988. So now I had CJ, oh, and there's a picture I sent you, and you can pull that up now. So this is a picture of me with the other female employees at PDI. And it was my baby shower. And it was actually one of my last days as a full-time employee at PDI. I continued to work for them part-time. Like, I would work like a few hours during the week helping them out. But as soon as I got pregnant, I was told by my big boss, Larry Tomczak, who was the head of PDI, that I could no longer work for them. Not because I was incompetent. I was told that I was one of their most hardworking employees, blah, blah, blah. But because I was a woman, John, and a woman, again, I'm going to bring in what Judith said in your interview. A woman has to be a Proverbs 31 woman. And she had to serve all her days as a homemaker and as a mother. And if you can homeschool, even better. And that was your place in the world. So even though I enjoyed my job and I was good at it, you know, they told me, oops, you got pregnant. So your days are numbered. So I just remember this day, like, you know, I was enjoying myself. They were honoring me, but I was also very sad, because now I lost my full-time job. And I wondered to myself, like, how are we going to make it, my husband and I, you know, because you know, we were struggling newlywed couple.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. So now we have talked about snowballs going down hills, churches that are businesses, Chick-fil-A, Target, PDI, which for people who don't know is People of Destiny International. I want to bring all of these things together and tie it to the research, because I think people will understand that there is a means, there's a method to the madness that I'm doing here. So William Branham laid all of the framework of doctrine that described what you believed in the 80s. People were talking about doomsday. It was a doomsday cult. Like it or not, that's what it was. He developed this into a system that was replicated, and many ministers replicated it, often taking what he taught as doctrine, but not mentioning his name. And so it was spreading far and wide. Branhamism was spreading, but in different names with different people. And at the same time as the snowballs going down the hill, church was being flipped upside down. You people are made for this church. And if you're not made for this church, we're getting ready to go. We're going to be the ones to leave. And if you're not with us, you're going to be doomed. I remember clearly that's what it was like in the 80s. And I was in Branhamism, but the far and wide this developed and grew. Branham died in 1965. Right after he died, if you look at the timeline and piece it all together, understanding what each person is doing, it looks like it was within months after his death. His campaign manager, Ern Baxter, and four other guys started the shepherding movement. Now remember, church has been flipped upside down. You people are made for us, the church. Well, now theology starts to build on this. The snowball gets bigger. It's not just that it's the church. You people are made to listen to us ministers. We're apostles, we're prophets, we're teachers, we're fivefold. You people were made to serve us. That's really how it got flipped upside down, although they wouldn't come out and say that. And then these five guys come up with a harebrained notion that it's a discipling thing that we're doing. We're going to create disciples, just like in the Bible. Only they did not understand that the disciples, Jesus was teaching them to serve others. It wasn't that the people were serving the disciples. And you find no scripture that says this. It just does not exist. So what happened? Because the church model was flipped upside down, now discipling was flipped up completely upside down. And they created it as a hierarchy. So you had the shepherds shepherding other shepherds to the people. And what is this? In business, we call it a pyramid scheme. There's the guys at the top, and then there's the little people at the bottom. So they created a business religious pyramid scheme. And if you follow all of the traces of discipling out to its marketing materials and its advertising materials, you're going to find, if you go through People of Destiny, the magazine, not the company, you're going to find shepherding all through it, because they were working like this. They were hand in hand. And it's the bridge to the NAR, because John Wimber is also being advertised heavily in this. He's buying into the shepherding. He's buying into the church model that's flipped upside down. But in Wimber's view, it's teetering. It's teetering back and forth between, I want people to have a real experience, but how do we give them experience? We've just had this Jesus movement where they don't know anything. We need to teach them. We need to shepherd them. And they're going to go every which way. So we've got to kind of control them and corral them. And so he used shepherding as a vehicle for a good purpose. But that good purpose started to go awry, because, like we said, if you don't grow the church model correctly, if you don't grow the business correctly, the business will fail.
Oh my gosh. I love how the work that you've done and your research, you know, based on the distant past, for me anyway, I was born in 1965, so the year that Branham died, apparently, you know, it's almost like, here we go. Now Pia Hugo and her experience continues this thing that got started, right, by all these men. So I feel like this is where the past and the present are now colliding, right? The 70s, 80s, and 90s. So you said that there were five men who pretty much started the shepherding movement. And I believe one of them was Derek Prince, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Derek Prince was somebody that was also very highly respected at PDI. In fact, Derek Prince spoke at a lot of the PDI conferences. And remember, I'm the assistant to the conference director. So it was part of my job to book flights, you know, from all these speakers from all over the world into Washington, D.C. for our national conferences. I had to book the limousine rides for these speakers and, you know, so that they could go to their hotels. I mean, there was so much money. And again, I am the assistant to the comptroller, so I also get to see the financial records. And I am literally like standing there at the PDI office, like kind of like shaking my head, like, how did I ever get involved with such a mega corporation? Like, I had no idea it was that big, you know, because, you know, the offices themselves were not huge. You know, our headquarters was in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Who's ever heard of Gaithersburg? You know, we had a decent sized building, but numbers don't lie, John. Numbers don't lie. I mean, we literally had millions of dollars, and this was in the 80s, going into, you know, our income streams. And again, as a young 20-something, that did not raise a red flag for me. It had the opposite effect. I thought, wow, I am part of such an important movement. So, but anyway, I'm gonna go back with you back to those the shepherding movement days, which then intersected with the take and give days. Okay, I'm gonna bring up take and give. They called it TAG. Most of your audience probably have never heard of it, but again, it's part of the folklore, right? This is like one of those amazing moves of God that brought CJ Mahaney, Larry Tomczak, and Cheon together. These three men, I'm guessing, were either in their teen years and early 20s when they started the TAG days. So Take and Give was a small little Bible study group meeting in someone's living room in Washington, D.C. And these three men open the Bible, because again, they're brand new believers themselves. You know, they got saved during the Jesus movement of the 70s. And so they decided, you know what? We don't need any of these older guys teaching us. again, going back to your interview with Judith, I think she said, we didn't trust anybody over 30 years old. So these young men decided, we're smart enough. We don't have any Bible degrees or anything like that, but you know what? We have the Holy Spirit and we are the anointed ones. So we're going to just open up this Bible and we're going to just teach straight from it. I mean, this is literally how they talk about the good old days of TAG, where they would just sit in the living room and eat their popcorns and drink their Cokes and read the Bible. And guess what? It worked, right? This simple strategy worked. And I'm even going to say this. Remember how we were saying how original founders and original leaders of some of these corporations were actually good people who just wanted to provide a good service. I'm even willing to say that these three men whom I've kind of gotten to know, you know, Che and Larry and CJ, they most probably had good intentions. They were excited. They were on fire. They loved the word because that's all they did back in the day was just read straight from the Bible. And they would have these lively discussions. And I'll even give them this. Holy Spirit probably did show up in those meetings, you know? But like you said, with growth, like with more power comes greater responsibility. And TAG grew to 2,000 young believers, all under the age of 30. So now, Che and Larry and CJ are like, whoa, scratching their heads. Like, I think this is bigger than what we anticipated. So enter Derek Prince, enter Shepherding Movement. We got to put some structure. We got to have some rules. We got to, you know, so now these hippies are embracing these structures that have been around for a while, like you said. So now this is the intersection, right, of Brahmism and Shepherding Movement. And now we've got TAG, and now we have PDI, because Derek said, you need an actual organization, you know, none of this take and give. What is that?
Yeah.
He didn't even like the name TAG. So they came up with PDI, People of Destiny, which personally, I don't like that name either. Like, no. What is that? But whatever, it worked back in the day. Nowadays, they call it Sovereign Grace Ministries. Okay, that's a little more churchy sounding name, right? But so PDI grew to from that first church called Covenant Life Church in Gaithersburg, Maryland. The second church was Cheon's Church in California, called Abundant Life Community Church. So both of these churches I was a part of. And then, but it grew and grew and grew so that by 1988, when I was now an employee of PDI, we had 40 churches all over America. So with more churches comes more tithes and offerings. I mean, it, like I said, it became this multi-million dollar industry very quickly. They had annual conferences. Like you said, they had the People of Destiny magazines. They had speaking engagements all over the world. They just became very popular very quickly. They also wrote books. So where I want to end our time together, John, is, I hope we have enough time, is this one book that totally ruined my family's life for many years. And it's a book written by Larry Tomczak. And maybe you can, you know, put up a picture of the book. It's called God, Rod, and Your Child's Bod. Have you heard of that book?
No.
I mean, what a title, right? Yeah. So to this day, it brings up a lot of painful memories for me. But God's rod, God the rod in your child's bod, was kind of required reading for PDI members. I mean, all church affiliated ministries and all these churches under PDI, like we made it like second to the Bible, because those of us who were parents within the organization, many of us were young. I was 23 when I had my first child. We had no clue how to raise our kids, and we weren't going to ask our moms and dads, because our moms and dads were over 30 years old, right? So they weren't, you know, they weren't part of this cutting edge movement. So one of the things that Larry taught was that you really needed to use the rod and you had to be aggressive with it. He taught us that we needed wooden spoons, and if one of the spoons broke because you were hitting your child so hard that it broke, you needed to have spare rods. And so those of you in your audience who know my story, I was married to an abuser, right? I was married to a narcissistic abuser who did not know how to control his anger. And so you basically give him a rod to punish his child. You're giving him a weapon. You're giving him a weapon to exert his abusive behavior. So my poor daughter, I mean, I remember her as a 2-year-old just screaming in pain. I'm sorry, John. It's still just very painful for me to remember. And she would be pleading with her dad to stop. And she'd say, "I'm sorry. I won't do it again." And I wasn't even allowed to interfere. You know, John, to this day, my daughter, who's 37 years old, and she's now a mother and a professional preschool teacher, she said, "Mom, you have no idea, you know, the harm that you and Dad did when you were spanking me with those stupid wooden spoons." I mean, I know that you're probably going to have people in your audience who are either, you know, they're either okay with spanking or they're not okay with spanking. This is not what this is about. I'm not just talking about spanking. I mean, I know the Bible, right? I know, you know, like spare the rod and, you know, spoil the child. But I'm talking about an abuser. An abuser with an anger issue. And when you have a church leader telling that man that it's okay to use an instrument to hurt your child's body, I mean, that is criminal. I mean, it really is in many states, right? It's illegal. Corporal punishment is illegal for a reason. But within PDI and NAR, it's part of the culture. And it's one of the reasons why I eventually had to leave my husband, because now he was using a belt. He was going to use a belt to punish my daughter. And I had to get in between him and my daughter. And she was only 4 years old at that time. And that was it. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. And I didn't look back anymore. So I just wanted to share that, John, because I've had some people ask me why are you exposing, you know, these NAR leaders? Why are you talking to John Collins? And you know, I mean, I think you know these are charismatic friends. And I told you, once a charismatic, always a charismatic. You know, I still believe in the spiritual gifts, you know, but I also believe in the whole Bible. Like, I don't cherry pick. I don't pick and choose my favorite doctrines or theologies. Like, we're all still learning God's word. But I'm here in your show because I want to reach the widest audience as possible. You know, NAR theology and false doctrines, they're not just harmful to our brains, you know, they're not just like, they don't just make for interesting debates. in my case, I almost lost my life because the Maynard leaders gave my husband permission to physically abuse me. And they gave my ex-husband permission to abuse my daughter. So I hope this has helped some of your, you know, some of the people watching today, John, and I'm just going to end there.
Well, I'm glad you went there because it gives me some information that I can use to tell the people that where we're headed is going to be explosive. So as I've mentioned, the snowball going down the hill, it merged with the discipling movement, the shepherding movement. One of the pieces of the puzzle that most people do not know, as you mentioned, was tag. If you pull tag out of this puzzle, people cannot connect the dots. That's the interesting part of this. And tag is just one entity of dot connecting. Whenever I do my research, people say, it's so complicated, John. How do you follow this? It's like you can't make a diagram. It's a splattergun mess of things, right? Well, that's the history leading up to the 80s. Now, when you get to the 80s, from the 80s to the NAR, it's an even bigger, more complicated mess. It's really, really difficult for people to understand. And a lot of it has to do with the Jesus movement. You had the Jesus movement. Picture it like a million wild horses. You've got a million wild horses who are perfect horses for riding, but you got to train those horses. How do you do it? Well, let's forcibly train them. Let's put so much weight on them that they can't run. That's what they did. They brought this concept that we need to discipline them. We need to bring them in together. We need to corral them. We need to give them so many overbearing rules that we break the horses. That's really what they were doing. They're breaking the horses of the Jesus movement. And they did it through entities like this. Well, what's interesting about it, the two things interesting about it, number one is they use many of the same concepts that Branham was promoting. I'm not even going to talk about it because if you go there too much, YouTube will block it. But go to my website and just type in physical abuse and you'll see it's advocating for beating people until there are welts. That's how bad it is. And not just children. I'm talking about the wives as well. It's pretty bad stuff. That was what Branham was making popular. Well, that fast forward into the shepherding movement. Now you've got that kind of thing existing in the shepherding movement. And it broke off into weird sects where adults were actually doing this to adults. They were spankings, adult spankings, kind of weird stuff. Well, this all comes back from the fact that they didn't really understand the Bible, they didn't understand the history, and you proved my point that I was going to build up to, which is kind of funny. Spare the rod and spoil the child is actually not a Bible verse. It's a verse from a poem, from a 17th century poem.
Look at that. I didn't even know that.
But they teach this because it is loosely based on a couple of Proverbs, and there are some passages that talk about discipline, but whenever you think about discipline, think of the ancient world. They stoned people back then, man. You don't want to stone people in this age. But that's what they were doing. They were trying to break the horses.
Wow.
And because they did this, they created the NAR. So I'll end it with that. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, John.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org and piahugoministries.com. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.